This is WJRH 104.9 FM, Lafayette College Radio, Easton, Pennsylvania.
This is our final show before the election night broadcast. And while we've been focusing on how the broadcast has come together and what needs to be done for it to be successful, tonight we will be focusing on the issues.
Each election is driven by certain issues, and while there were a lot of topics that deserve discussion during this election season, we have chosen three to take a closer look at. We interviewed three professors at Lafayette that are experts in the fields of job creation, climate change, and healthcare to get insight into why these issues are so important and what the candidates have done to address them.
Professor Susan Avert is an economics professor here at Lafayette and holds a PhD in economics from the University of Colorado Boulder. Her current research focuses on mostly health issues in terms of economics. We sat down with her to gain insight into why healthcare is important in this election.
Thanks for talking with me, Professor Avert.
I am glad to be here, Chris.
So the Affordable Care Act is an incredibly dense and complicated piece of legislation. So if you were to simplify it, how would you describe what it does?
Absolutely. So the Affordable Care Act had two aims. The first one was to extend insurance to groups that have historically been uninsured. The United States has been somewhat unique in having a very large portion of its population uninsured, around 44 million persons before the Affordable Care Act was passed. And that's unique among industrialized countries. And so the Affordable Care Act wanted to reduce the number of people who are uninsured. That was a primary aim. And it did that in several ways. We can talk about that if you want. And then a secondary aim was to try to reduce rising health care costs.
So what exactly were the provisions in the Affordable Care Act that targeted just bringing people into the system, essentially?
Exactly. So for those people who didn't qualify for Medicaid, who were not old enough for Medicare, and who didn't get their insurance from their employers, those people were actually a pretty heterogeneous group. So one provision, which has turned out to be incredibly popular, would be to allow persons like you mm-hmm. to remain on your family's insurance until you're age 26. Because
right,
a big chunk of that uninsured was, in fact, people who were after their education, but they didn't have a job that offered health insurance. Another one was to encourage the states, at the federal government's expense, to expand Medicare eligibility, okay? For the states that actually expanded that, that made a huge dent in the uninsured. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. a number of states turned down basically free money from the feds to do this.
Yes, I was actually, Maine was one of those states
from
that just said
refused,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And so they turned down money from the federal government to expand Medicaid.
So wait, and the states would not be paying for that expansion?
It was the federal government said, we'll pay for it. We want you to expand the eligibility. And they said no.
Okay.
And then another one was to have an individual mandate, was to say to people who didn't have insurance, we're going to pool you all together. We're going to create exchanges. Each state can each create its own exchange, or the state can have the federal government create their exchange.
Yeah.
So pool the risk of all the rest of the people who don't fit in the other two bins that we talked about. Require them to buy insurance, right? By requiring them to buy insurance, you're spreading the risk. You have the healthy in with the sick. You're mm-hmm. keeping premiums low,
okay.
and you are subsidizing those people who don't have enough money so that everybody can actually have health care.
So what were the specific provisions that were targeted at lowering the cost of the health care itself?
Not as many. The Cadillac tax, trying to have these accountable care organizations, so aimed at finding better ways, more efficient type of care. But those were definitely a secondary, I think, kind of thing.
Okay. So it was definitely more focused on just bringing people into the healthcare industry.
Bringing people
into the insurance industry.
Okay. That's right. Getting people covered.
Okay, so in the presidential debates, anytime healthcare comes up, rising premiums is this word, or these two words that are just thrown around.
Yep.
So what can be done about those rising premiums in terms of making sure that they don't in fact happen?
Right. So premiums have risen. They've risen quite a bit, and you're right. It's receiving a lot of press. And part of the reason is in the group that was uninsured that went to the exchanges, that's where premiums have been rising. And what's ending up happening is that anytime you're selling insurance, you need to get a large pool of people to buy in. And then you need to figure out the probability that somebody will become ill, and then you can price your premium accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening is that a lot of the people we'd hoped to come in there opted not to buy the insurance and decided to take the penalty on their taxes rather than actually buy insurance. And those were people who tend to be relatively healthy. Right. And so what happened was the insurance companies paid out more than they thought they would. They basically didn't price it as high as they thought it might go, right?
Yeah.
And so that they need to, a couple things need to happen, right? Obviously, a repricing has to happen, but also you need to draw more people in, right? You need to figure out more that this, any insurance company isn't going to be profitable unless it has a whole bunch of people pooled together. And so, for example, but you think way back when we first started having employer-based insurance in the U.S., when Blue Cross and Blue Shield were looking at this, they actually went to where people work because, of course, people who are working are healthy.
Right.
Right. Okay. So that was a pretty good risk pool. Now you're getting down to people who are less healthy. And so even President Obama has even been canvassing the country, urging people to sign up for insurance to help spread the risk.
So the only way to be able to provide health care at the cheaper rate that Obamacare wants, that cheaper rate, the only way to do that is to make sure that there are enough people signed up in this pool.
That is not the only way, but that is a big, important way.
Okay.
Absolutely, right?
So what could be some potential alternatives to lowering the cost?
Well, providing the care more efficiently. We, in the U.S., we've really been hesitant to actually ration care like they do in some other countries, right? So we've basically rationed on ability to pay, whereas in Canada, they ration on availability. In Britain, they go further and they say, well, these are the things we'll pay for and if this isn't approved, right?
Okay.
So one of the things that Affordable Care Act looked at was evidence-based medicine, right? Trying to only reimburse things for which we have hard evidence that they actually work. Those are harder to do. It's harder to bend the cost curve in that way because we are used to getting what we want from our healthcare providers.
So those healthcare providers, what is their incentive to be part of this marketplace? Because as far as I understand, you enter the marketplace as a provider through your own will, and you're there providing insurance for previously uninsured people.
Oh, so as an insurance company, your incentive, of course, if you are a for-profit company, is to enter the market because here are some potential customers, right? And if you can get the pricing right, you can hopefully increase your profits.
So right now, those providers are moving towards leaving the marketplace.
Some are, yes.
And so, how do you bring them back? Is the only way you do it make sure that you have more people in the marketplace itself?
I mean, that's one way, right? Or the other way too is subsidizing so people can actually afford it. The Affordable Care Act does provide subsidies for folks.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yeah.
So how would you change the system so that it works for people that are getting the health care?
Wow, that is a really tough question. You know, one of the things that got talked about is the public option, right? If there isn't if these exchanges, also people could actually have a public insurance option where you have something along the lines of Medicare, which is a single payer option that works reasonably well in the United States, right? You don't see a lot of people complaining about Medicare.
Right.
And you certainly don't see anyone saying, let's repeal Medicare, it's socialist medicine. So a public option is potentially something to think about. Thinking about increasing the penalty so it's harder for people. Mm. One thing that I think is tough when people are relatively healthy and they are struggling to make ends meet and they're looking at an insurance premium of $1,400 a month, that's a lot of money, right? So either increasing subsidies, increasing the penalty so that it's more expensive to go without the insurance is also a possibility. But, you know, it's understandable at some level when people are making trade-offs, right? I think it's important that some people think, okay, I'm healthy, I'm young, and you never know what's going to happen to you.
Right.
You know, one bad bite of a hamburger and you could end up with E. coli and healthcare costs have been one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in the United States. So,
What do you think is what is stopping a public option from happening? Like what I guess political forces make sure that doesn't happen while Medicare is accepted? And
That's a good question. And I think, I mean, it is political. I'm not sure that I know exactly what political forces are, but I think it is more political than anything else. And People worry that that's, you're on a slippery slope to going down a path, right? And I think there are worries about, okay, well, you know, if I have to wait 10 years to get a knee replacement or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. People really worry that a different kind of a system and a different kind of rationing could, in fact, hinder their ability to get care.
How would a public option work economically? Would that be, you know, an increased tax on everyone to help the few that can't, or help the people that can't pay for the health care? Is that essentially how it would work?
I mean,
that
would certainly be one option, right? You could increase payroll taxes, which is one thing that you could do.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, you'd have to think about how would you want to do that, right? Would you do it payroll taxes? Would you do it through the federal income tax?
Right.
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our second guest is Professor Kataline Fabian, a professor in the Government and Law Department who got her PhD from Syracuse University. With a focus on international politics and the role that climate change plays within that, Professor Fabian told us how future generations will have to deal with this problem. All right, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Fabian. So the first question that I have for you is, what are political steps that can be taken in order to help climate change?
This question is very loaded, and the answer is endless. And people have been trying to address this question. First, the scientific community trying to provide evidence that this is happening. This has been the last 25 years that finally we reached that place with at least there's conclusive evidence. It doesn't mean it's the truth, but we are getting very close that there is an agreement that this is happening. Doesn't mean, again, everybody believes that. But first is awareness. And from awareness comes a series of actions. And the course I teach is exactly looking through from the literature the different types of actors, and all those actors need to act together. There are different levels. You and I can do some, but our scope would be very limited. If the two of us cooperate in an NGO or the local environmental group, for instance, LEAP or other groups which are also on campus, we can accomplish a little bit more. From NGOs on the domestic sphere, as long as they connect internationally, they can reach out and often pressure governments and also transnational corporations or even smaller local businesses. Not everywhere the biggest is the most and only important economic actor. And of course, states can cooperate. So if you think from individual, as individuals organize social movements, environmental movements, which are again many decades old, as they have changed their focus and increasingly started to see how interconnected the global climate change issue is, and then to economic interests, and then states and international governmental organizations. So all of these actors are all people, all decision makers. Some are profit-oriented or non-profit, but still would have some kind of economic activity like businesses. For instance, education is very important in that. But there's quite a debate. For the longest time, people thought that governments should do all the work because, you know, they pull an enormous power, both economically and normatively. And these states, for the longest time, didn't want to act, in part because of the global inequality. That is that most of the highly industrialized countries, such as the U.S., Canada, most of Western Europe, would have gone through industrialization, and they're the ones who have produced most of the greenhouse gases, which have led to even the current level of global warming. So countries who are picking up industrialization, Brazil, India, China, said, well, you produced it, you're responsible. And indeed, as of 1990, we do know that the greenhouse gases are causing climate change. Before that, you could argue that, you know, 1700s on, the industrialization people didn't know what they're doing. But as of 1990, there's no way to deny. We did have that scientific evidence, even if it wasn't conclusive. So while we looked at the states and expected that they would make the difference, it is a very difficult process because countries are in very different positions. to do so. And that's when many environmental movements and also individuals like you and I started to act, no matter that their scope and their abilities in the international sphere are over the scale of an agreement as between states. But all of these levels started to engage. And it would be ideal if you could not only agree, like with the scientific community, but all of these normative steps would be the same in China, India, and various parts of the United States. But, you know, we are in different levels, different locations, different privileges, and different difficulties. So it's very hard to expect that people would be acting the same way. Most of us are looking at energy consumption in different ways. Some are very obvious: heating, light, transportation, but also some aspects also which are very high in greenhouse production, and for instance that's meat production and agriculture. For the longest time, people assumed that the only place to look at is indeed the industrial production, but it got much further, and people realized we carry that burden within the food, within the housing, within the transportation aspect. So there are multiple areas, from the very local, very individual, to the state level and then the international. And all of these, they're partial successes. And people say, oh, we haven't reached anything and this is doomsday. But there are a lot of successes, but they're partial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, going off of that, so obviously it's very complicated, but bringing it down a little bit more to the United States specifically, where do you think the United States is in regards to how we handle climate change, both on a more local United States level and more on a global level as well?
It's a very important question, and indeed we need to look at always on the local and the global level. And here the local is the U.S., but the U.S. is very diverse. California has had a cap and trade. It's less known, but it's working, just like that cap and trade system which the Kyoto agreement put forth. But the U.S. didn't sign that. As so many other international agreements, the U.S. has been very reluctant to be part of the global climate change negotiations. So Kyoto in 2001 was one of the agreements where the U.S., although helped make it happen, but eventually didn't sign, with the argument that it would hurt economic output. And that's the traditional argument for many economies, including China and India, with a very different consumption pattern. So we are using so many more resources, and there's plenty of data to back it up, from water to electricity, also greenhouse gas output, what Americans put out. So based on responsibility, the U.S. should have been there. But it didn't feel that it would need to stand up for that historic responsibility, instead arguing that the economy is more important to focus on. So the U.S. has not been a leader up until the Obama administration, who has been trying to pursue, for instance, the Copenhagen Agreement, which fell apart, and the most recent Paris Accords, which took place last December 2015. And eventually it was President Obama who agreed, in particular with China, to push this agreement, and it looks like it will be a binding, the first binding agreement on global climate change. But it will not happen if not every person, a big majority, really doesn't sign up for this. And that's what I see, that it has started to take place, that there's more agreement that this needs attention, that people are willing to shift some consumption patterns, that they're willing to at least balance some of those air travels which we do with planting. It's not the same, different locations, but realizing the individual consumption causing and adding to the already very precarious condition, which historically previous generations, but we are just as part of it, put both this country and the global environment.
And then bringing it to the current 2016 election, How do you feel the discussion surrounding climate change has been going, and how do you see the future of climate change following the election?
The future, as a political scientist, I know I shall not talk about, because political scientists always, as far as I can tell, think that we can tell the future, but usually we lose out on very important markers. To me, 1989 and 90, which is the end of the Cold War, is one very important such signal. We totally missed that. Most people did not have a clue that this is going to happen. So it just makes me very cautious to say what will happen. What looks like in global climate change, that it's a dramatic change in a very small period of time, and that's what we have been seeing for the last 15 years. Increasingly is the hottest year on record, hottest month, if you remember September and October. The type of weather even we see right now is increasingly hot, and that may be very pleasant, but it also produces enormous risks, both for a certain box to survive, the animals not being able to reproduce the same way, the whole agricultural pattern with lack of water in many parts of this country, facing enormous problems of sustainability. And we know that, at least if this trend continues, and there's a very high chance that it would, we are really risking a national security and global security, food security. So I see that this issue was actually less of a debate in greatly because of the awareness and the evidence. The scientific evidence is becoming much more readily available, less debated. There are still people who deny it and question it. But there is an increasing willingness to recognize both that this is happening and we need to do more. So what I see, if I still dare to go on to the projection side, that with those little steps, which individuals, NGOs, business can and start to do, it's so little. My guess is that at some point we will be going to very high-tech and very risky geotechnology, which may change the atmosphere, reflect more light, do something with the increased greenhouse gases. How and why are we going to do that? This would take an enormous investment, a major government decision. It would be probably very difficult on a global scale, and still everybody would be affected. So all of these very high-tech solutions, I think at some point may be necessary, but there is a huge risk in implementing them. But I do see that it may happen. Maybe you come back 20 years from now, and if I'm lucky enough, we could still talk about that.
All right, thank you so much for joining me.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Our final guest is Professor Julie Smith. With a PhD from Johns Hopkins in economics, Professor Smith has a focus in macroeconomics. During our talk, she was able to provide the intricacies of employment, job creation, and tax policy.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Smith. We just have a few questions for you, specifically starting first with unemployment and the current labor force participation rate. Could you talk about the relationship between those two statistics? And how this will all be related to the upcoming election and possible policy following the election.
Sure. So the unemployment rate measures how many unemployed persons there are divided by the labor force. And the labor force is made up of both those persons that are employed and those persons that are unemployed. So, and to be unemployed, be counted as unemployed in the United States, you have to be actively seeking work. So that's the first thing to just sort of understand about what that unemployment rate means when it's sort of released every month by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's related to the labor force participation rate because the labor force is obviously made up of those persons who are employed and unemployed. right? So, you know, some of the discussion since the financial crisis and the Great Recession and the slow recovery we've been having has been about, well, that labor force participation rate has gone down. So part of that decrease is just due to structural changes in the economy, the largest being that baby boomers have been aging, and as they age, they retire, right? And when you're retired, you're not counted as being part of the labor force. But another portion of that decline, or a piece of that decline in the labor force participation rate, comes from the fact that there are a number of what we call discouraged workers, so people who lost their jobs but now have given up looking for work, and so they're no longer counted as unemployed. So this is this strange sort of relationship between the two, because obviously, you know, employed plus unemployed persons is how you get the unemployment rate, but you can flow into and out of the labor force, right? So the people that are retiring, they just sort of have gone away. So we don't really need to worry about those. But, excuse me, what happens when you sort of have a recovery, and I think some of this has been seen in the last few months because the actual unemployment rate that gets reported hasn't changed very much, sort of over the summer and the fall, is that people are coming back from, say, being discouraged workers, and now they're looking for work again and finding jobs. So that's kind of the relationship between the two of those. Now, the question about how does this relate to, say, either Trump or Clinton's policies of job creation, part of that has to is difficult to tell because, you know, they say a lot of things, but you have to look at the underneath policies. So one of the issues that both candidates have talked about is about illegal immigration into the United States. But to keep in mind, when we have illegal immigrants, most of them, or a portion of them at least, are working in the United States. And so they do make up almost 5% of the labor force. So if you take Trump's policies to have large deportations of illegal immigrants in the United States, that actually is going to further drive down the labor force participation rate in the U.S., which will most likely lead to less production, right? And so lower, say, real GDP in the economy as well. And possibly from, depending on how large scale some of these deportations are, could lead to a recession, you know, starting, you know, maybe a year after his administration would take office. Clinton, she has basically looked at a very different side. She's talked about trying to, one, legalize the status for a lot of illegal immigrants and also increase immigration for both high-skill and low-skill workers. Right. And so some of what might happen then is it actually would allow the U.S. to produce more. It would increase the amount of labor in the economy. And so we would have higher production and possibly higher, you know, or most likely higher GDP going forward. So I think if we want to just think about in that one part, like what's going to happen to unemployment rate under the two scenarios, you know, with Clinton's plan, it's most likely that the unemployment rate's going to stay about where it is. But with Trump's plan, it's very likely that the unemployment rate would start to rise, you know, when you get to late 2017, early 2018, because of just this one part of dealing with basically illegal immigration in the United States.
Great. Thank you. And so now I've been seeing in the news recently that wage growth may be beginning to be on the rise. A few news sources have reported that I've seen. Can you talk a bit more about what that specifically means for the country as a whole and going future?
Right. So one of the issues that sort of has remained from the Great Recession that we had and the very slow economic recovery that we've been in is that wages have been pretty stagnant. Right. So workers haven't been taking home greater income or have greater hourly wages. So some of that has been attributed to the fact that there's something called slack in the economy, right? So when you have a recession, unemployment rises, you have a lot of unemployed workers. So economists call that there's a large amount of slack in the economy. Right? So when there's a lot of unemployed workers out there, then firms, you know, when they offer someone a job, that person doesn't have very much bargaining or negotiating power because if they don't take the job at sort of the wage rate, then, you know, the company will find somebody else. What has been happening is you can start to see is that unemployment rate has become steady. The labor market has tightened up a little bit, meaning there's really not that much slack in the labor market. And so what happens then is that workers can then demand higher wages And then we start to see more wage growth for those workers in the economy. It still doesn't address sort of people who have been out of work for a long period of time, obviously, because they're not, a lot of those people are not going to come back into the labor force now. One good thing about having wage growth is if you think that wages, that labor, say labor makes up about two-thirds of production, right? So workers are really integral to making goods and services in the United States, is that when wages start to grow, it will push up inflation a little bit because there's some pass-through from wage growth to the overall inflation rate, say in the consumer price index. So you might think, well, having greater inflation, well, that's a bad thing because things are getting more expensive. But the Fed, the Federal Reserve, has been really challenged lately with inflation rates that are really low or below their 2% inflation target. And because of that, they've been sort of looking for ways to try to push inflation up, you know, just a little bit towards 2% so that we are not caught in a situation where we have some sort of a negative shock to the economy, and that would push us, say, back into a recession, and then we would risk having inflation fall even further, and possibly even worse than that, having a situation where we have deflation, where prices are actually falling.
Going on to a little bit more broad of a topic, specifically related to the election, how do you feel that job creation as a whole has been handled in the zeitgeist as people have been talking, both the candidates, the respective parties, and just people in general throughout the whole election process?
I mean, I think there's a real concern about job creation because what we've seen over the last 40 years is that income inequality has grown dramatically. So what's been going on is that lower skill, lower educated workers don't have necessarily the jobs available to them that they had, say, in the 1960s or in early 1970s. And that's because there's been a structural change in the economy. And that change in the U.S. economy has really become that we're just a much more capital intensive, right? So we use machines to do more things in the production process. So if you look at how cars are manufactured today, right, they're going to use a lot more robotics than they used, say, going back to the 1960s, where it was more human power that was putting putting cars together. So that change has left a lot of people with the, say, inability to find work now because they don't have the skills for the type of jobs that are being created right now. So I think, you know, so if you look at a lot of Trump's policies, right, so he is somewhat, or he's come out against trade, and he said, well, he wanted to impose tariffs both on China and Mexico. And those are, you know, two of our three largest trading partners. So with that, it actually, when you impose tariffs, right, you're going to raise the price of those goods. Manufacturers and producers are not going to bring those jobs necessarily back to the United States. They're going to look for other, you know, countries where labor is cheaper and try to switch manufacturing to there. So I don't see how his plan to like sort of revive manufacturing is going to happen because that's not what the U.S. economy, the structure of the U.S. economy is really based on now. If manufacturing jobs come back to the United States, those jobs are going to require very few workers, and they're going to require a lot of capital, a lot of machines. They're going to be very technologically advanced sorts of jobs that people have, and so people are going to need more skills than, say, a high school graduate would have. And so they would need some post-high school training, whether that's some sort of technical training or community college training. So I think that is a mistake of Trump's, that he's thinking that, well, we can just bring back the jobs we had during the 60s and the 70s. And keep in mind that in dollar value, we produced more manufactured goods today than we produced sort of at the height of manufacturing in the United States. So it's not that we don't have manufacturing in the United States. It's just we don't have as many workers employed in the manufacturing today because instead of workers, we use machines to produce those goods and services. I think, you know, if you go to a lot of Clinton's policies on, you know, sort of expanding education, that's what workers need in order to get sort of the jobs that are being created today. So she has some proposals to expand community college and make community college and four-year colleges more affordable. She also has policies that you might not think are related but are very important, especially for women, about having affordable childcare, because a lot of the reason why women sort of stop working after they have children is that childcare is just too expensive, right? So it doesn't make sense for them, economic sense for them, to continue working because they can't find childcare that costs less than really what they're making. So that, as a family, you know, that people make those decisions, well, I'll just give up working because we can't find affordable childcare. So I would say that those policies are going to help actually more people work. And so we would have more workers and be able to produce more. Some of the policies, she's also proposed a higher minimum wage, and the Democratic Party has obviously endorsed Bernie Sanders' higher minimum wage proposal, and Clinton's is, minimum wage that she's proposed in her policies is lower. And you look at that, that should actually, a higher minimum wage should actually help those workers that keep their jobs. There will be small effects on employment. There are some people that will lose their jobs. But there will be some, for the workers that keep their jobs, there will be higher wages, and those higher wages will actually help those people move away from as much public assistance as they might be receiving now. So people might be able to get above the poverty line, and there's a lot of federal programs that households' participation in is dependent on whether their household income is above or below the federal poverty line. And so with a higher minimum wage, if you can shift families into being greater, having income greater than that poverty line, then you know, you're actually freeing up some resources from the government spending part of the economy as well.
Great. Is there anything else before we wrap up that you'd like to say on the election in general in relation to the economy or anything that you've been thinking about this election season?
I think, you know, one of the other issues that we just might want to think about is at the end of the day, right? We've talked mostly about the spending side and sort of job creation side, those programs, but we also have to look at their tax policies. And tax policies, both of their tax policies have been evaluated sort of by independent economists, you know, and think tanks. Because at the end of the day, right, the federal government, let's just talk about that part, right, takes in so much revenue from taxes, and then they have so much they have outlays on government spending. And if you look at their two policies, what they've proposed, I think it's important to keep in mind that with the number of tax cuts that Donald Trump has proposed, that really what's going to happen is that the federal deficit's going to expand, and then the national debt's going to expand as well. And so we might want to think about, you know, well, what does that mean? Because this is something we eventually have to pay back. And so we might want to have a situation where the government debt isn't growing so much. You know, it's not clear, you know, Clinton has also proposed some tax changes, but for the most part, she's proposing increase in taxes, especially on high-income households, to pay for the programs. And so I think it's important that whatever the candidates end up doing, you know, or whoever gets elected, that they conduct this in a fiscally sound way, because that debt is something that future generations, you know, of Americans and even people who can't even vote yet, that are they're going to have to figure out how to deal with. And so I think that's an important part to think about as the candidates, you know, as people go to vote, and also then as whoever wins the election as they're in office, that we fiscal policy needs to be a responsible for not only the current generation of voters, but, you know, future generations of Americans as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to all three professors who have given their insights into why these issues matter in this election season. This is our final radio broadcast for the House of Pards, and we look forward to our election night broadcast, where we will be giving you up to the minute results of what's going on in the country.
Yeah, make sure to tune in next Tuesday, November 8th. We'll be on the air on PBS 39 from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Should be a great time. Good to see both me and Chris, see what our faces look like after just hearing our voices for all these weeks. But yeah, we really appreciate you guys listening, and hope you have a great final week before the election.